Hello, I'm Jonathan Bullard, and you're listening to In Conversation With. Welcome to In Conversation With, and I'm delighted to say that my very first guest is a former NHL defenceman and also played a bit in the Elite League as well. It's a warm welcome to Ruminander.
Thanks for having me, Jono. It's great to talk to you. Great, you know, lead up this new season with your podcast. I'm actually really excited about that.
Well, thanks for joining us. I've got lots of things to discuss with you, as I'm sure you're aware. But I want to really start with what you're doing now. And you're the head coach of the Elgin Middlesex Chiefs, a major midget AAA team in Ontario. It's your first season as head coach at this particular level. So what is your role there? I assume it's to get guys ready for the OHL if they're good enough to be drafted there.
Yeah, it's a kind of a two-way street, you know. And I told the kids this, I told the parents this before our season started. I'm trying to get the kids ready to play at a higher level in the OHL, which is you know one of the best feeding system leagues for the NHL. And I'm trying to get myself ready to go back to the NHL. You know, it's kind of a two-way street where we need each other. You know, I need the players to play well. I think they need me to teach them well to get to the next level. So it's something that we're going through right now. It's been a good, tough process, but we're managing it right now.
I've seen from how you're doing this season, you're fourth out of the eight teams in your division, but it is quite close at the top there.
Yeah, no, it's a tough. It's a tough old league, that's for sure. It's a lot of good players right on down. I mean, we had a game last night, and we played, I think, the fifth place team, and they came into our place in Elgin, and they beat us pretty handily. So you can't take nights off, and that's the biggest thing I stress to the kids is consistency. You know, you need a coach and a scout, all those things. They need to see you play consistent hockey every day, and those are the players that you see develop and go to the next level. So once we get our kids kind of doing that, and it's tough, but it's once we get them doing that, they'll be better off for it.
You mentioned your ambition is to get back up to the NHL. How does this ground you? What is your sort of coaching style at this level?
I'm really, I think of myself as an old school, traditional old school coach. My first year in the American Hockey League, I had John Tortorella as my coach. And everybody knows, you know, his style, his history, very successful, but very demanding. And that's the type of approach I kind of want to take. I want to go in that way. I had Craig Hartsburg. He was an NHL coach, a great successful NHL player in his day. He was my coach in Guelph in the OHL my last year. So those guys were really very influential in my career. They helped me get to the places that I did get to. You know, I'd very much like to, you know, follow in their footsteps and achieve the kind of success they did in the coaching ranks.
Okay, I'm going to take you right back now, because I think a lot of people who know you will know you was born in Nigeria but moved to Canada when you was very young. How old was you when you made the move?
I was a year and a half. You know, I think I was closing in on 2 years old by the time I think my parents moved us to Canada. Mm.
How old was you when you took up hockey?
That's a different story. That was it was something that you know, like when I consider myself, you know, I know I was born in Nigeria, but I very much consider myself Canadian, you know, and you know, if you hear my parents speak, they speak with an accent. You know, I have a very much Canadian Ontario accent. So I very much consider myself Canadian more so than I do Nigerian. But that was not it was not easy for my parents to let me play a game that they were very unfamiliar with, mm-hmm. you know? So, I didn't actually start skating till I was 8 years old. You know, I always wanted to play. I begged them and I pleaded with them, but they didn't like what they saw. We grew up, when we got here, it was the '70s, and when they would watch the hockey games, all they would see was brawls and players going into the stands. So it was something they said.
That's interesting, considering how your career turned out. Obviously, we will go on to that later. But obviously, a time when I suppose the Philadelphia Flyers were in that pump and winning Stanley Cups.
Yeah, the Broad Street Bullies. So they thought it was just the game that I was going to have no part of, but. You know, finally, a great friend of mine, his father convinced them to get me on the ice. And the first year it was figure skating. I had to figure skate. They said I couldn't play hockey. So, okay, I took up figure skating for 1 year. But I said I had to wear my hockey skates. I wasn't going to wear figure skates. I was wearing my hockey skates. I was wearing my full gear. So, I did that at 8 years old, and my first year playing on a team was 9. So that's very late if you think of the age the kids start nowadays. So,
as a black player in a sport that doesn't generally have that many black players representing it, mm-hmm. were you affected at all by racism while you was growing up in the game?
So, the answer is yes. I don't want to say that it was very bad because I experienced racism when I was in the schoolyard, school sometimes. So, yeah, it was. I mean, it was very, it was the very few times throughout my career. And I would say it was more so when I was younger and growing up in minor hockey. But so soon as I, towards junior and pro, I didn't experience it very much at all. But It was there, and that's the honest truth. You know, I can't lie about that.
Why do you think it was more prevalent when you was younger rather than as you got older, like you say, towards the pro ranks and the top minor leagues? Is mm-hmm. it that just that sort of thing that kids can be cruel? You said it was something that you experienced in the schoolyard as well.
Yeah, I think it's immaturity. I think when you think back to the things you do when you're a kid, I mean, I still. At times consider myself a little bit too immature at times. So I think it's just immaturity. The things kids say, they don't think about it. They don't think ahead consequences of what they say, their actions. So that's a lot. I would say that was a lot of it. You know, maybe there are people in this world that are, you know, that are racist, they don't think that blacks should play hockey or anything like that. So, maybe that's a part of it. I mean, you can't rule that out. I just think that it wasn't something that I faced every single game or when I went to every rink. There were signs in the stands. It was nothing like that, but it was definitely there at times.
How does it make you feel now when you hear stories of this still happening? I mean, we're in 2019, and this still goes on. Does that still affect you now?
It does. It really does. It sickens me. You know, I think everybody in England will know when they listen to this that I'm a huge football fan, a soccer fan. And to hear the stories out of, I think it's Italy, you still hear them out of Spain, I think it is. And it amazes me that in this day and age, it's still happening. And like at stadiums where there are thousands of people, all the things that the football federations have done to try and curb it and try and get rid of it. It amazes me that it still happens. I don't think it's as prevalent. I know it's not as prevalent on this side of the ocean. So, you know, I mean, obviously there are things we still need to do to make it better, but it does. It really does. It truly does amaze me that it still goes on.
Just going back to hockey for a second, and obviously you are a black player who made it to the absolute pinnacle of the game by playing in the NHL. But still now you're, I suppose, what could be considered as a rarity. I was looking at a report earlier today, and it says that only 3% of players in the NHL are actually from an ethnic background. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that there are so few ethnic players who are playing the sport at the top level?
That's a tough question. You know, I think with hockey, I think the first thing that people think about is money, is the cost that the game demands. I think nowadays, especially, the cost of playing and the cost of playing at the highest level, I'm talking from, you know, 8, 9 years old, is just, it's astronomical. The numbers, some of the numbers I've heard. So, okay, so you say, okay, it costs a lot. But then you're saying that families, non-white families, don't have those kinds of means. And then now you're going into something different and you're saying, why don't those families have the same kind of means that white families do? So I don't know. I think you could talk for hours and you know, you still wouldn't come up with an answer. I don't think we have the time here to tackle that one, right to the core, right to its core. But it is a myth. You would think there would be more. You would think the game is so open now. They're playing games in Mexico. They play games pretty much. I know there's an ice rink even in Nigeria, the country of my birth. So yeah. I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure why the numbers haven't risen. You know, I think the numbers should have risen more, and it's kind of a mystery to me.
Do you feel that anything or enough is being done to actually change that fact?
Yeah, another tough question. I know when I was playing in New York, we had a program. It was called Hockey in Harlem, and it was getting right into the New York inner city and introducing the game of ice hockey to the inner city kids in Harlem. And that was a great program. It was led by Willie O'Ree. You know, I think he was the first black player to play in the NHL. So he was giving back, and he was trying to create an atmosphere where we could get more kids of color to play the game. I think in today's day and age, I think there are so many other things to do. You know, there are so many other sports. You know, I think there's a resurgence in soccer, football in America especially, but in Canada as well. So a lot of the kids, they don't grow up playing hockey as their first sport anymore, especially in Canada. I think soccer is the most enrolled youth sport that we have in Canada now. It's a tough thing because programs have been out there and people have been trying. But with so many other things to do, so many other things that are cheaper, people generally tend to drift towards those options, I would say.
Obviously, there are role models out there, and one, PK Subban, stands out above all others. I mean, he is an incredible role model, not just for black players, but for the whole of the hockey community.
No, yeah. The things he does off the ice, I think, are so impressive. When you're able to do those things off the ice, I think you have to be a special talent on the ice. So he's had to work hard. And I don't know if everyone knows, like, if you watch his Instagram, he'll post pictures of himself working out and the things he does to make sure he's at the top of his game year in and year out. I think it's great that an athlete like PK can donate the kinds of money that he does to Children's Hospital in Montreal. But I think that he has to work as hard as anybody else to make sure that he is at the top of his game, so then he can command the type of salary that then he can do those other things off the ice. So I think it's a great lesson. If you watch his trajectory from kid getting drafted into the OHL and then progressing into the NHL, the work never stops. And that's some of the things that I try to really instill in our kids that we coach this year, is that getting drafted is one thing, that's great, but the work really never stops. You know, you have to keep working. The greatest players work the hardest. They actually work harder than everybody else. It's people don't even think that in their heads. You know, they just think, oh, that guy's just naturally gifted. But Of course he is, and a lot of the great superstars are, but they actually work hard, and they work harder than most. So it's great. He's a great example of all those things.
I want to focus on your hockey career now, and you played in the OHL for Guelph Storm. While you was there, mm-hmm. you were drafted by the Buffalo Sabres. And then once you finished in Guelph, you went to the Rochester Americans. Your first pro season, 95-96, they win the Calder Cup. That must have been some experience.
Yeah, it was a great year. I think I said earlier that I had John Tortorella as our coach. And he was a no-nonsense coach. He worked us so hard in an era where, you know, it was a lot of it was hard work. And if you can outwork the other team, you had a chance to win. You know, today it's a lot different. It's a little different, you know, with the skill level. And it's not as physical, maybe, the game. But we just had a very simple, no-nonsense kind of game plan every night. Outwork the other team. It took us a while. We were second last in the league at Christmas. And the season was going nowhere. And Coach Torts just kind of brought us in. We regrouped. We had a couple guys sent down from the Buffalo Sabres, which was our parent club. You know, we kind of just got back to basics and went on a great run second half of the season. Got into the playoffs hot, and we stayed hot during the playoffs, and we lifted the Calder Cup, which was a great memory.
What sort of mental strength does it take to win a championship like that throughout the whole team? Because this is a team that obviously has to play the regular season and then goes to the playoffs with the prime goal of winning a championship. Yeah. It must be incredibly mentally tough to play at that intensity night after night.
Yeah, it was tough. It was really challenging. It was my first year pro, coming off 3 years in major junior in Canada. We only play, I think it was 65 games, 66 games we played. That was our regular season. Pro hockey, American League, was 80 games. It was 80 games that year. So you don't think 14 games. Well, you count preseason games. At the halfway point of the season, I had played. That was probably my whole junior season right there. If you count the preseason games and the practicing and all that and the travel, which was crazy on your body. So it was tough. There were days where I didn't have it. I could say to myself, I don't know how I'm going to get through this game. You know, I have no energy. But you had to find a way. You know, you're playing pro hockey now. You're actually playing for a living, for your career. So there were days where it was tough. You had to dig deep mentally and just find a way to perform, find a way to lift the team with a big fight, even though you know you don't have the energy, the stamina. So it was a tough grind. When you look back and you see the success that we had, it just brings a smile to your face because you know the tough moments, the hard moments, and we got to lift the trophy. Not everybody does that at the end of the year, so we were the ones that year. We were the ones that kind of grinded it out and got to lift the cup. So it was, God, it was a special year. It was great.
You mentioned there about being on the road, and I think that's something that we probably don't appreciate over here in the United Kingdom is tough the road trips are in North America. Because it's not like here where your longest road trip is to Dundee and you go there and back in a day. Yeah, whereas in North America, you are on 7, sometimes 14-day road trips.
Yeah.
I mean, that must take a toll.
It is crazy. And in the American League, where predominantly it's, you know, a coach bus, we would drive 18 hours through the night after a game. You literally are showing up at the next rink on the bus. Like, it's not even you get to go to a hotel and have it. We are showing up on the bus, getting ready. This is like, get off the bus, get into the rink, get ready for warm up. If you've ever tried to sleep on a coach,
it's not easy.
You know, that's not easy. It's tough. And I think the American Hockey League is great for that, for preparing guys. Because one of the greatest things I always said to guys was, we got to get to the NHL so we can start flying around so we don't have to sit on the bus. That was one of the greatest motivations that I had. Let's get to the show so we get to fly. We don't have to sit on the goddamn bus. It's a great learning ground for up and coming NHLers and just I guess life in general, because you have to go through so much, and you have to be prepared every night.
Well, of course, the following season, you did make the NHL. You made your NHL debut for Buffalo. How was that for you? Did that make you feel like I've made it? All the hard work, everything has prepared me for this moment, and now I'm here, and now I've made it.
Yeah, I think I could touch on this later. It was a great feeling. It was a great sense of achievement. But I think for me personally, I always wanted to make it to the NHL. And then when I did, I kind of said, okay, that's it. And I kicked myself. I'm 44 now, and I look back and I can shake my head at some of the terrible, awful mistakes that I've made. And one of them is just not driving more, I think, after I made the NHL. And this is going back to talking about my years in New York, the year in Atlanta. I think I got too complacent when I got to the NHL. I said that was my goal. And maybe that was just, there was too much immaturity on my part to think that, okay, this is the goal and you've done it and you've succeeded. All that hard work, you did it. Then I think I rested a little too much on the achievements that I had there.
You played just 3 games for Buffalo over 2 seasons. Did that not give you the sort of motivation that when you went back to the AHL that I've got to get back up there again? Did that not kickstart you a little bit?
Yeah, I would say that was, you'd be right saying that. I'm talking about kind of when I think when I got to New York and it was kind of like they said, okay, you're going to be here for a while. That was generally the point where I think I let off a little bit. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, when it was up and down, when I finally got to play my first, you know, regular season NHL game, it was one game, couple practices the next day, and then they sent me down. When you get that taste, and I think they do that to select kids, even now, they say, here's a taste, this is what it's like. How bad do you want it? How bad are you going to work hard to get back here full time? I was determined. I wanted that so bad.
In the next season, you were traded to the New York Rangers. 36 games you played there over the regular season. You played with some legends. Some absolute legends.
Yeah.
Obviously, the likes of Mike Richter in goal. You've got Adam Graves. And, of course, you have Wayne Gretzky playing on that team. Yeah. What was it like for you to walk into that locker room and there is arguably the greatest player to ever play the game and you are on the same roster as him?
It wasn't even a dream come true. I could never imagine myself playing with Wayne Gretzky, Brian Lee, you know, Mike Richter. I tell people this all the time. It was the stuff of fairy tales for me. I couldn't believe it. The first time I met the team, I was in Buffalo when it wasn't sort of a trade. It was I got put on waivers by Buffalo and I was picked up on waivers by the New York Rangers. So I met the team in Toronto. You know, I walked into the swanky hotel that we were staying at. I walked in with the PR guy. They had picked me up from the bus terminal or whatever it was. And they were showing me to my room in the hotel. And Wayne Gretzky was actually in the lobby as I walked into the hotel. So he was the first person I met. I was a 10-year-old kid living in Hearst, Ontario, born in Nigeria. And watching Wayne Gretzky win Stanley Cups. I couldn't have dreamt that one day I would play with that guy. I was seeing this legend of the game winning Stanley Cups and doing just the most amazing things on the ice. And then I think it was 13 years later, I was meeting him. I was playing on the same team as him. I couldn't believe it. I shook his hand. He said, oh, welcome to the team. You know, he recognized that I was the new guy. And he goes, welcome to the team. Nice to meet you, Ruman. I'm Wayne Gretzky. And I couldn't get words out of my mouth. I shook his hand for like 10 seconds and I didn't say a word. I couldn't speak. So that took a while for me to get over that when I was walking in the dressing room and seeing guys like of that stature. So it was exhilarating, but it was tough at the same time because I couldn't believe who I was around, and that took an adjustment period for me as well.
What was he like in the locker room and on the ice as a leader?
And there's another story I tell my friends that he's the most amazing teammate that I've ever had. Like just one of the guys, the greatest player to ever play the game, and he was just one of the guys in the dressing room. Make a joke, he could take everybody would would make a joke to him and he could take it. It was amazing. And I couldn't believe the atmosphere in that locker room. It was very much an older team. I was coming in, I think I was 22, 23 years old. And, you know, I'm coming from Buffalo. The way they accepted me and welcomed me into the group, it was great. Those are memories that will last with me forever.
You mentioned there the greatest player that ever lived. Do you think his records will ever be beaten?
I just don't see how they could. The game has changed so much. If you look, and this is not I don't want to say this as a knock on the great Wayne Gretzky, but if you watch the highlights of the goalies back then, good God, the goaltending is so bad. It looks like they don't even want to stop the puck. They're scared of it. If you just look at how better goalies are now, how defensemen are coached up to the highest level. I think back then it was forwards. It was all about scoring. And defensemen were big and just try and clear the front of the net. That's all you were supposed to do. Just clear the front of the net. And if you can get it up to the forward, get it up to the forwards. But now it's so specialized in every aspect of the game. I don't see how you can have a guy scored 200 points in the NHL like Wayne Gretzky did. I couldn't see. There's no way that can happen again.
Of course, at that time, you had some incredibly talented players in the NHL, legends as well, the likes of Mark Messier still playing, Chris Chelios, for example. Mm-hmm. Now you've got a different breed. You've mm-hmm. got the likes of Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews, Sidney Crosby, Alexander Ovechkin, mm-hmm. Steve Stamkos. It's a different breed of players. It seems to be more emphasis on skillful play now.
And that trickles down to every level of hockey. So everybody emulates the best. And when you see, I watch video to prepare our team, and you see McDavid's and you see Stamkos, you see Ovechkin, you see Crosby, you know, you see Matthews. The game is at a level that I don't think people could have expected even 20 years ago. It's taken off to crazy levels. But you know what? Now that's the style of game that we have to teach our kids. You know, we have to get them prepared, because that's the way it's going. You know, it's very much a skill game, very much a speed game. Every single player on the team, from your top forward to your sixth defenseman, they have to be skilled. They have to be able to take a pass, make a pass. You know, make a skill play in tight areas. Those are the best teams that can get 20 guys on their team able to do those things. So that's the challenge for us coaches. You know, it's to emulate what they do at the top level and try as much as we can to bring it to the kids that we coach. So it's been tough, but we keep trying.
You leave New York, 27 games in Atlanta, and you didn't play further in the NHL, and you've mentioned already about your regret that you didn't take it further, mm-hmm. but you play 69 games in the NHL, mm-hmm. which is 69 games than probably the vast majority of people who ever strap on a pair of skates and go on the ice. So while you say that you do have regrets that you didn't play more, you must still be incredibly proud that you reached the pinnacle of the sport.
Oh yeah, definitely. I wouldn't trade my experiences for anything in the world. I'm so happy that I got to experience some of the things that I did. We talked about the Calder Cup earlier. Getting drafted to the OHL was something that I'm still proud about. Playing on a great, amazing OHL team that we had. We had Jeff O'Neill, we had Todd Bertuzzi, Jamie Wright, which, you know, people don't know, but he played for Team Canada at the World Juniors. We had just a great junior team. And then you go to the American League, you get drafted by Buffalo, and you have to make your way up. That was a third round pick by Buffalo. You don't just make the team and you get to play right away. You know, you got to go down. You got to go down the minors and earn it. And so proud of the things that I tried to do to get myself to the NHL. And when I got there, I just exhaled. You know, I think I exhaled a little too much. I mean, I don't want to get into it too much, in that way. It's just off the ice stuff was going on, and but it was the greatest moments of my life, sitting on the airplane playing poker with legends of the game after a game in Boston, and we're flying back, and you just get to you get to share stories with just legends, and it was I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I know I should have done better. I should have played more, but I had a great time. I had a great stint. It was those are memories that I'll keep with me forever.
After Atlanta, you are around the minor leagues. Yeah, you went to Austria, you went to Slovakia, and then in 2006, you find yourself in Great Britain with the Coventry Blaze. Yeah. Before I talk to you about your time with Coventry and Nottingham, what were your impressions of the British League, the Elite League, before you actually arrived?
I had no idea. That year, I was out of contract. I was kind of at the end, you know. It was 2 or 3 years after my NHL, my last kind of NHL games, maybe even more than that. And it was kind of the end. It was like them saying, okay, you know what? We've given you every chance. We just don't see it now. So I still wanted to play. I had to look elsewhere. And it's not too much of a stretch from the truth to say that, like, one of the guys, I saw Andre Payet was playing in Newcastle, and we had some history before then. People would probably know that after seeing us play against each other for 3 or 4 years there. But I saw he was on one of the teams, so I said, all right, kids, pack up your bags. I think we're going to England this year. I owed him some payback from an incident in Philadelphia in the American League. So and you know what? Hockey players are brutal this way. They don't forget little slights that happen to them. And there was an incident in Philly where I got into a fight. I think I fought twice that game. And Payet was one of the guys on the other team. I didn't fight him because there were tougher guys on the team. I remember he skated by the penalty box, and he was just laughing at me. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get that guy back, man. I'm going to get him back. And it happened to be 6 or 7 years later when I went to Coventry. So that was really, like, people might think this is crazy, but I actually wanted to get Andre back just to make him remember who I was, you know. So he went to Coventry. You know, I wanted to play hockey for sure. I wanted to keep playing the game, making a little bit of money. But yeah, I knew Andre was there, so that's why I came back.
Of course, that first season in Coventry was incredibly successful. You won the Challenge Cup, you won the Elite League title. Paul Thompson coached the team, who was incredibly successful time at the Blaze then. And of course, you was back with your teammate from Rochester, Barry Moore, as well in that team. Did it sort of rekindle your passion for the game in a way, because you was on a successful side doing so well in that rink, which is incredibly atmospheric when it gets going as well? It must have been great that season.
That season, and I think you said it right, it rekindled a passion inside of me. You know, when we get that rink, when we had that rink rocking, it was just an amazing feeling. It was one of those things where you come in, it was our motto was the first 5 minutes. You know, they hate this. It's a small barn. The first 5 minutes, just jump all over them. The crowd would go nuts. So for me and a lot of guys that came over that year, we weren't used to the British way of supporting ice hockey. So it was different for us because it was, you know, it was crazy. It was very atmospheric, you know. So we got into that, and we fed off that. And we just had a great group of guys. You have to give credit to Tomo, our owners, Andy Buxton, coaches. And sometimes you don't get it right. You know, sometimes you do everything you do all the research you can in the summer and you think you got the right mix, but you just don't. But that team was just the right mix of guys. We got along so well. And I wouldn't even say it was like, because there was a number of married guys, there was a large group of single guys, but we just got along so well, and we gelled right from the start, right immediately. And that team just took off, and we fed off one another, and we just rode that wave, you know, all season long. And Tomo there behind the bench, just a great coach, great motivator, great players coach. He'd give back. He'd give us a little bit if we gave him what he was looking for. That was a great year. We had so much fun. Obviously, with the success, it makes it even all that much better.
You was re-signed for the next season, but unfortunately, you only managed a couple of games, and then you got a bad neck injury, which saw you out for the rest of the season. And although the success continued with Coventry winning the Elite League title again, how frustrating was that for you, not being able to be a part of it, but I'm sure itching to get back on the ice and itching to be a part of that success once more?
When I look back at that year, where I am now and where I want to go is because of that year. You know, I never thought about coaching. I had a plan for what I wanted to do after hockey. It wasn't where I'm at now. So that year was the year that I said, I want to stay in hockey and I want to coach. So it was tough. The flight over to England is where I first experienced the bulging disc in my neck. And I was in excruciating pain for this 9-hour flight. And I was like, what is going on? I couldn't understand what was happening. You know, and then they did a battery of tests and they found the problem. So luckily for me, for my family at the time, that they actually kept us there. I mean, Coventry had no... They didn't have to do what they did, but they kept us there. And I got to talk to Tomo every day, Luke Chabot. I was taking stats every game, and I was watching practice, seeing things I would tell guys about on the ice. So that is the year, how terrible it was for me personally, just playing-wise, not for the team, because we were very successful again. But for me, it was just an awful year that, you know, I'm sitting on the sidelines and not involved, and you're not fully involved when you don't play the games. You know, I got to go on the ice for the celebrations, but you know, deep down, you didn't contribute. But that is the year that I said I'm gonna be a coach. You take positives out of every negative, and that's what I ended up doing that year. And you know, now I'm here, and now I'm trying to build to something even bigger.
Once that season ended, was there a thought that you might go back to North America or even retire? So was it a surprise that when Corey Nielsen came knocking on the door and asking you to come to the Panthers?
It was more than a surprise. I think it was. I was shocked. I was completely shocked because I said, "You know what's going on here with my, you know, with my neck, with my injury." And the first thing he said, "Well, how is it? Are you able to play?" And I said, yes, I've been clear, but I just want you to know that that's out there. And he was like, yep, we know. So I was shocked. You know, I thought it was done. I thought it was game over. So when I got the call, I think it was an email he had sent me. Could you please call me back? So, yeah, it was one of those lifelines you get, you know, sometimes in life. And you get like a bit of a second chance. And, you know, you try to take advantage of it. And I just went there. I had loved British way of life, let's say. So I loved it in England. And I definitely wanted to go back. My son was a big soccer player at the time. So I wanted to do everything to help his maybe development for the future. So that's, you know, that was another reason why I wanted to go back, so he could learn the game at a different level than he would ever have learned it here in Canada. So there were so many factors involved, and to get another opportunity through Corey and Nottingham was such a blessing.
But again, you come from a team who was incredibly successful. Nottingham had had their own success, winning the playoffs and the Challenge Cup the previous couple of seasons over Mike Ellis. Corey Nielsen was now the head coach. And that must have been a frustrating season, because it was so close, challenged in the league, got to the final of the playoffs, but just missed out. As good as it was for you, there must have been some frustrations that you just missed out on the major prizes that season.
Oh, yeah, for sure. All around. I think that was another great team. We walked in, everybody walked into the dressing room the first day, and it was like we were old friends from bygone years. So it was amazing. Everybody gelled. We had some new characters come on the scene, like Jade. I think Galbraith came in that year.
Yeah.
We had some great characters on that team, but yeah, it was tough. I think even personally for me, you know, I got hurt again. I tore ligaments in my thumb in a fight. So I missed 6 weeks again or something like that. And then it was like, you know, as an import over there, it's tough. What do they do? What do they do when an import is out for that long? Do you keep them around? Do you say, you know, here's your walking papers, you know, we can't keep you around. So it was tough personally again, you know, with injuries, but team wise, we were getting there. We were so close. And Corey's a great coach. I think he's showing that now, but I think that was his first or second year as, you know, player head coach. And that's so much on your plate to do. That is insane. I don't know how someone does that, but he handled that with such class and he's just a hardworking guy, and he stressed that to all of us. And we worked hard. We battled. I think we fell short. Ultimately, I know, you know, of course we fell short, but that was a great coaching effort, I think, that year by Corey, for sure.
One incident I do want to pick out from your time at the Panthers is, I think it was the first home game, and Rick Kozak of the Hall Stingrays attacks Mark Leavers, leaves him in a pool of blood, and then kicks the blood as he goes off. You was having a fight at the other end of the ice at the time. Kozak gets a long ban. The ban is then cut on appeal, and of course the first game he's back would be against the Panthers at the Hall Arena, which is still now a memorable game.
Yeah.
So many years on.
Yeah.
But I remember that virtually the entire Panthers team was chasing Kozak around the ice for the full 60 minutes. You got a 10-minute misconduct within the first few seconds because you dropped the gloves with him and he just didn't want to know. It almost seems a crazy situation now, but it was one of those sort of situations where, I suppose for you, you had to play in it and as a spectator had to see it to actually believe what was happening in the game.
Yeah, you know what? So many memories from that game. I remember us driving to the game, and we actually had a meeting in the dressing room. I think it was before the game, and we said, what are we going to do? I said to everybody, I'm taking care of this, okay? I'm taking care of that. I didn't want everybody feeling nervous or what, like, who's going to take care of it? I'm going to take care of it. And it was set up on a platter for him to take his medicine. If you're going to act like that, it happened to be, we are there for his first game back. And it was set up for him to say, okay, I got to take my medicine here. We're going to do our dance. And you know what? That's it. You know what? You do that. You act like an idiot. Then you got to face the music and it's over with. But he didn't. I lost so much respect for him in that moment. If you're going to act a certain way, then you better back it up. And I don't think he backed it up. I don't think he did himself any favors. I was there. I was ready. He wasn't. The game went on. I think he left the league after four or five more games. So in the end, it was all show. But you know what? I think the England fans and the British fans, they can see the phonies. And if he was really true to his character of kicking blood and being this crazy character, then he would have, you know, he would have answered the bell there, but he didn't. That's who he was. So I don't have anything more to say about that.
When I look through your career, you obviously were an enforcer. If you look at the AHL, 272 games, 1,025 penalty minutes. In the Elite League, 102 games, 404 penalty minutes, and your job was, in some respects, to fight. But what sort of toll does that take on your body, both physically and mentally, when, you know, you get that tap on the shoulder from the coach and, like, Reuben, you need to sort this out. But you're doing that night after night. It must have an incredible impact on your well-being.
Yeah, it's a tough role because it doesn't affect you in that moment when you're fighting. It actually affects you the whole day. So when you have a game and you know, especially that whole game, I knew I had that game circled on the calendar. It was coming up. You're thinking about that every day leading up to it. But then you're thinking about, okay, now we're playing Sheffield and we have to, I have to deal with these other guys. So I think it's a crazy kind of cycle that you have to get yourself psyched up to do that battle. And the battle is only a fight only lasts maybe 30, 40 seconds. Those are long ones, maybe. But you have to do so much to get yourself ready, you know, mentally and just psych yourself up that even like that's maybe when I was younger, it kind of came natural. It was just like I was a little crazier and wilder, and I would just go into it. But when you get older, you gotta get yourself ready to go and prepared, and you want to do a little research. Which hand does he throw with? What does he like to do in his fights? So when you break it down like that, you're actually doing research and all that, and it's a tough thing, you know. It's a tough thing to go into battle knuckle to knuckle with another man. You could take one right in the temple, like I've done many times, and I've fallen flat on the ice, knocked out cold. You kind of shake it off. You do your concussion test, whatever it is, and then you come back and you do the same thing. It's crazy. People think, what are you doing? You just got knocked out. But when you kind of grow up and you want to make it to a certain place, and you do everything you can to make it, and that's what I did. I did everything I could and to make it, and that was the role I kind of got slotted in. So I was happy with that, and I did everything I could to play as long as I could, but it was tough. It wasn't easy, but I enjoyed every moment of it.
Do you think it was necessary? And I sort of want to add to this question in the fact that I remember Dan Tessier, and I think it was around the time of that whole game. Dan mm-hmm. Tessier, of course, your teammate in Nottingham, who said that when you was on the ice, he felt 6 inches taller because he felt protected, and he felt he could probably do things that he wouldn't normally have done because he had that protection there.
When I hear that, I get a warm feeling in my heart, because that's the kind of presence that I wanted all my guys, all my teammates to feel. Just saying that like makes you think you have to say there's another guy on the other team who felt that way too. You know what I mean? So you have to deal with that. You have to say, okay, we're going to challenge each other right here, man to man, right in center ice in front of, you know, 8,000 people. So pressure, even now, I don't know why that's gone out so much, as much as it has. And I'm talking specifically over here. Is fighting so in the Elite League as it once was? Or
No, it's very much diminished. There was two fights, actually, in the Nottingham-Belfast game recently, and everybody was like, wow, two fights in the game. We generally don't see two fights in 10 games now. It's very much changed.
What I was trying to say was I understand why I can understand why fighting has, you know, two people dropping their gloves and trying to smash their knuckles into the other man's face. Where's the guy that's going to be just competitive and going out there and playing hard and playing gritty and making his teammate feel 6 inches taller? Where are those guys? Those are the guys I want to get on my team, you know, that I want to coach, because I don't understand why that has gone.
Mm. You said earlier about how you're having to change the coaching style because you're changing, you're coaching kids with regard to skill and speed. And it does seem that side of the game has definitely almost been eradicated.
Oh, yeah. No, I like I said, I don't understand why. Why is that? Because when I talk to scouts, so our kids are their dream is to play in the OHL or Division I major university in America. And when I talk to all the scouts and the evaluators, they say we're looking for competitive, hard nosed players. That's all they're actually looking for, the players that everyone says, no, you can't be like that anymore. You have to be all skill and all, but they're looking for the guys that play hard every night. I said this earlier, I think today, consistency, the guys that they're going to play the same way every night. Those are the guys that, you know, everybody wants. They're going to play hard every night. They're going to make the hits. You don't have to make a crazy highlight reel hit every night, because those aren't there. But if you go hard, you play hard, you play physical, those are the guys that everyone's looking for. But for some reason, people say, no, you have to be all skill. And I don't want to diminish how important it is to be skillful and to have a great hockey IQ, because that is what I look for as well. But why can't you be both? You can be both. And that's the kind of thing that I kind of stress to my gut.
Just moving on to something completely different, and your son, Malachi. You mentioned him earlier when you was playing in England. He was an excellent, as I'll call, football player. You'll call soccer player. And he had a trial with Sheffield Wednesday a couple of years back, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. It was that was kind of a special moment, because we had been back over to North America for a while, and he was progressing well in the ranks over here. I think back then, definitely, he was a true, true football fan. You know, we support Arsenal, and we've been to the Emirates Stadium in London to watch them play. So in his heart, his first love was football. So to get that call, to get that opportunity to go come back to the UK, I think it was for a week there. It was really a special moment, and I think he'll remember that. He still has the Wednesday jacket and memorabilia, so it was a great moment for him so he could remember that. You know, if he sees that stuff again, he can remember the things that he went through and in his youth.
But your son is 6'8" tall, and is an excellent basketball player, and has been signed for Brown University in the NCAA next season. How tough was it for him to actually make that decision? Because he obviously excels at two sports. You have to make a choice. That must have been very tough for him.
You know what? It's a strange thing, because I think he just outgrew. He outgrew. And I think maybe if we were still in England, they would figure out a way. I know Peter Crouch is he a similar height? I don't know exactly how tall he is.
6'8", 6'9", yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know, so maybe they would have figured out a way where he could keep playing. But we were over here now. We were back in North America. It was like, okay, 6'5" now. It's like, and he's still playing, you know, he's still playing basketball. He's still playing volleyball. But his first love was always football, soccer. So he was playing all the competitive teams. But then the next year was, you know, he grew another inch or two. And then the basketball team started saying, okay, well, come on. Like, we have to, this guy needs to be on our team now. And my brother, a Canadian university star over here for basketball. So then now he started getting him out to the gym and teaching him, specific basketball moves and techniques. I think he outgrew the sport. It's weird to say he outgrew soccer for over here. Like I said, I think if we were over there, they would have figured something out, and maybe it was a different position or something like that. Maybe learn a different skill set. But over here, just kind of he just transitioned to another sport. And you know, he's very competitive like I am, so he wants to win at everything. And so as soon as he took up basketball, it kind of, you know, you go to one level, then you go to play against the kids in Toronto, and once you know you're good with those kids, then you say, okay, I can play with these guys. So that's where it kind of just took off from there.
He's going to Brown. He's going to be playing in the NCAA. The ambition is going to be drafted by the NBA. You obviously reached the pinnacle of your sport. What advice would you give him?
Well, the advice I've given him and I continue to give him is to not even think about that. I mean, I don't think he has the same. I was a very confident, maybe arrogant kid at the time. I just was like, nope, I'm playing in the NHL. That's all I'm doing. And I'm going to make it. And I just think the nature of it of now, and especially for him being from Canada, taking up the game so late, and not that late, but later on, it's so much harder. So his focus is get better at your sport every day. Learn the game, get a good IQ of the game. I always say this to the kids I coach. You have to learn the game by watching it or you know, studying it, reading about it. You gotta get a better IQ of the ins and outs of the game. So he's doing that now, and you just gotta get better and get better. Be successful where you are, because the NBA is a million miles away right now. So just get better at everything you're doing at your prep school, because he's at a prep school in just outside of Boston right now. And then next year, you're going to a great university, a great learning institution. So make sure you take care of your schoolwork and get better. Everyone can do both. You know, you can be good at school and in the classroom and on the basketball court. So just keep working hard, keep getting better. You know, his next 4 years after this year are set. I think that's a great comfort that he has, that he doesn't have to worry about where he's going and what's going to happen. The next 4 years are set. So now that's kind of a comfort. That's a safe zone. So keep working, keep getting better and striving, you know, to be the best. And if he does those things, I mean, that's going to be success in life. And that's the greatest thing you could kind of hope for your kids, you know, growing up.
You mentioned earlier about how Malachi and yourself would go and watch Arsenal. And yeah. Anybody who follows you on social media will know that you are a obsessive Arsenal fan. How and why did that come about? Why Arsenal?
I was asked this question a number of times when I was in England. And the one game, the one game I can remember, it was Arsenal-Man United at Old Trafford, and Arsenal got destroyed. And
then, was that the 8-2 game?
No, it was long before that. It was a 5-1 game, I think. It was a 5-1 Man U win. And for some reason, I watched that game, and I said, I will be with you till the end. And I was talking about Arsenal. I honestly, I can't tell you the moment. Maybe it was... It might have been the same year that won the Euros with the World Cup. Did they win a Euro and World Cup?
Yeah,
World Cup.
So back to the World Cup in 98, and then the Euros in 2000.
And then 2000. Yeah. Yeah. All I remember is being Arsenal through and through, and I can't tell you the moment. I don't know why. You know, maybe I grew up in a French community. So maybe that was, I try and think, is that why? Maybe because the French connection with Wenger, because it was Wenger. Wenger was the coach.
Yeah, and there was Vieira and Petit as well.
Yeah, yeah. Henri came. Yeah, like you said, Vieira. So maybe that was the connection. And because I understand French fluently. I don't speak it very well, but I don't. And like, I'm rambling here, but I don't remember the moment, but it was always Arsenal, and it will always be Arsenal.
It's a great story. Getting close to wrapping up, but one thing I did want to ask you before we finish is, it's what, 10 seasons probably since you last played in the UK, but you're still remembered here with a great deal of affection. That must make you very happy.
That does make me happy to hear that. I tried to play with my heart on my sleeve. I tried to give everything. My role was, you know, it wasn't very like skillful as the game is today. But I think I was an entertainer. You know, I tried to entertain the crowd. I tried to protect my teammates, and to be remembered makes me feel very, very good about, you know, hearing things like that.
Well, Ruben, I just want to say thank you so much for being my first guest on In Conversation With. It's been a pleasure to speak to you, and thank you so much for being so open and honest.
Oh, Jono, that was great. You know, it was a great trip down memory lane. Thank you for that. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you. Take care. Thank you again.
Many thanks to Ruman Under there for his open and honest approach to the interview. I think you'll agree he was a great listen. If you want to keep in touch with In Conversation With, you can do on Twitter. It's at JBInConvoWith. And you can listen to the podcast on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer and Spotify, amongst others. I'll be back soon with the next edition of In Conversation With, so please keep in touch and look out for that. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.